National Gallery Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. We start this episode with news of one of the most exciting projects ever imagined and realised by the National Gallery. Drawing on the powerful stories of change found in Titian's three masterpieces, Diana and Actaeon, The Death of Actaeon, and the recently acquired Diana and Callisto, Metamorphosis, Titian 2012, is a multi-arts event, which will feature new work by contemporary artists Chris Ofili, Conrad Shawcross and Mark Wallinger, in a unique collaboration with the Royal Ballet. The project is part of the Cultural Olympiads London 2012 Festival, and Michelle Penn met up with curator Minamor Eid to hear more.
Well, Metamorphosis Titian 2012 is a hugely ambitious project, really, in which we have commissioned a whole constellation of artists, so three visual artists, seven choreographers, dancers, a group of poets, three composers, to respond to these three very great late mythological paintings by Titian, and to produce a body of new work that will be both on display at the National Gallery as an exhibition, and which will be performed at the Royal Opera House.
And can you tell us a bit about the Titian paintings themselves? What is the story behind them, and how are they inspiring the various artists?
The three paintings that we're focusing on, Diana and Callisto, Diana and Actaeon, and The Death of Actaeon, are part of a larger series of mythological paintings that Titian made for the Spanish king, Philip II, between about 1551 and 1562. And Titian himself selected the subject matter, and our three paintings derive from the Roman poem Ovid's Metamorphoses, which is a wonderfully vivid, witty narrative poem that tells of the lives and the loves of the gods. But together they form a group that tell the story, or tell episodes from the life of the goddess Diana, who is a fantastic a sort of figure of girl power, really, in many ways. She was the goddess of the moon. She was a huntress, fantastically strong, but also, you know, legendary beauty, very seductive, very beguiling, but terrifyingly cruel. So she had this sort of dual nature. And that's something that Titian really brings out in these paintings. And as we will see, it's something that all three artists have extracted for their responses.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the various artists are responding to the three Titian paintings?
Well, in a fantastically diverse way, which I'm thrilled about. I mean, Chris Ofili is the painter of the three of them. We always wanted to have a painter as one of the three contemporary artists, because Titian was a virtuoso painter. So it was very important to continue that line. And Chris is an artist who's never afraid of addressing established narratives or biblical subjects. And that was also important when thinking about which painter to choose. And he's also a painter who can work on a huge scale. Mark Wallinger's piece will, I think, be the most extraordinary surprise for everyone. He wanted to find a contemporary way to depict Diana. He thinks that it is very easy for us to forget how shocking those paintings would have been at the time. In his room, there will be a bathroom in which you will see inside, glimpsed through peepholes. You will be able to see a real, live, naked woman. I suppose he's trying to find a way to remind us of the sense of intimacy that is created between naked Diana and her naked nymphs in the painting of Diana and Actaeon, and what it means when Actaeon trespasses into that moment. Conrad Shawcross's work, both for the National Gallery and the Royal Ballet, uses a robot to personify the goddess Diana. Next to the robot, there will be an antler, which has been carved by that robot. And the antler is, of course, has a lovely formal relationship with the Titian paintings as the animal into which Actaeon was metamorphosized. It is Diana's post-mortem, if you like, on Actaeon. It is what happens after what we see in the Titian paintings. His piece is a kinetic sculpture that will be moving and changing all the time, so it really embodies the very act of metamorphosis. It's a fantastic twist on that idea.
So aside from these really fascinating works that the artists are putting together based on the Titian paintings, you've also arranged to work with choreographers and poets. Let's talk for a moment about the collaboration between the National Gallery and the Royal Ballet.
This is just a tremendously exciting collaboration, really a unique collaboration between two of the world's really great arts institutions. But we are, of course, neighbours because the Royal Ballet is just up the road in Covent Garden.
So it's not just an exhibition, it's actually an entire event with these ballets happening as well.
Yeah,
exactly. It is also three new ballets, so a new triple bill at the Royal Opera House that will be performed on four nights, the 14th, 16th, 17th and 20th of July. And in fact, on the 16th of July, it will be relayed live to 22 different UK venues. So it doesn't matter if you don't have a ticket, there will be 22 outdoor venues all over the UK where you will be able just to come and watch those performances relayed live. It is without a doubt the most exciting project that I've ever worked on, and I can't wait to see the results.
Thanks to Minamore Eid. So, how do you turn beautiful but static masterpieces by Titian into three new works for the Royal Ballet? Well, each of the three artists showing at the National Gallery will also be producing stage sets for a new production created in collaboration with Royal Ballet choreographers and a contemporary British composer. Among those working with painter Chris Ofili is choreographer Will Tuckett, who invited Michelle Penn backstage at the Royal Opera House to hear how things were going. Michelle began by asking how he and the other choreographers had gone about translating the interactions of the characters within Titian's paintings into movement on the stage, and particularly the key moment in Diana and Actaeon when Actaeon first spies the goddess.
We spent quite a lot of time looking at them, actually, in the studio and on my iPhone. Because randomly, what you can do, because you can't keep nipping down to the National Gallery, is you can zoom in on little details and just pick out little things. And also trying to explain how, when Titian was painting them, how bold he was being and how direct her look is towards him, and trying to find a way of exploring that now. How can we create something that feels that direct as a way for Marianella Nunes, who's playing Diana for us, to look at Federico, who's the dancer, Federico Anelli, who's playing Acton. And we messed about with that quite a lot. So yes, we have developed a physical language out of the paintings, but not perhaps in the way that one might initially think.
I suppose that's the creative process anyway, that you start from one, you start from a germ of an idea and it grows and it changes and it goes all over the place.
Yeah, you have to allow it to go where it wants to go, and every now and again keep it in check, because often that'll bring you back to the better idea, because you'll go off on a tangent and realise that actually Titian's idea was better. Like most of the time, yeah. Yeah.
I know Chris Ofili's set design is sort of transposing the Metamorphosis tale to Trinidad. Mm. And how has that affected the way that you think about the choreography?
It hasn't hugely, actually. He's given it heat. When you look at it, the colours feel hot and it feels very sensual. And you don't go, oh, look, it's Trinidad at all. And so in a way, almost knowing it feels like a slight red herring, because what he's done, he's created a sort of mythic, quite abstracted landscape. And so working with him was a real eye-opener, in that it's the first time he's done a stage design. For me, it's second nature how a lot of things work on stage. And if you have no idea how it works, it meant that actually it's a very fresh perspective on it. And he's found it really exciting, I think, because a lot of the time you're in a studio and you're not collaborating as a visual artist. You're sort of doing your own thing. You're on your own. And you can't put on a show on your own. You need costume makers, set painters, builders, there's choreographers, and there's all these other people. And I think what's quite nice is we're all shouldering that responsibility, which I think was quite weird to begin with, but actually is quite a relief. I find it a relief anyway, yeah.
One of the things that I'm kind of curious about are how you think audiences will react to your ballet, in terms of people who are used to seeing perhaps something that's a bit more classical, seeing these Chris Ofili sets, hearing the music. How do you think that audiences will react to that?
I think as a team, we're enjoyably old-fashioned, actually. It doesn't feel as if we're doing something outrageously modern. which I'm rather enjoying, actually. And I hope that an audience will feel the thread between what we've done and the Titian and the Ovid. We really like telling stories. It's what I get a big kick out of. And so I'm hoping that the story is evident. And so as a result, an audience can relax a little bit. It's always terrible when you sit there and wonder if you're not getting something that you feel like you're supposed to be. When quite a lot of people say, "Oh, I don't really understand dance," and there isn't really much to understand about dance. It's a bit like music; you can just sit and listen to it, and you don't have to get it. You can see whether you like it or not, and which is to be quite like painting. I hope it's that. I hope people's response is they understand where we've come from in terms of it being a take on the Titian and the Ovid.
Perhaps they understand that it's something that there are these old stories, but they're still quite relevant to our lives today.
Yeah, exactly. There are lots of things about both... oh, that's fantastic. There you go. Bit of an opera in the background. And I think the fact that different generations find something new in those old stories makes it always fascinating to work on when the smell of the past is brought up so close, so quickly like that.
Thanks to Will Tuckett. The three new works will be performed at the Royal Opera House by the Royal Ballet on the 14th, 16th, 17th and 20th of July. Check the Royal Opera House website for tickets or come along to a free outdoor screening on Monday the 16th, when the performance will be relayed live to a big screen in Trafalgar Square and many other venues around the UK. The exhibition opens at the National Gallery a little sooner, on the 11th of July. Admission is free. And if you're planning a visit, you might like to know that the audio guide features an interview with curator Minimor Eid. And we'll have more about Metamorphosis Titian 2012 in next month's episode, when Nobel Prize-winning poet Seamus Heaney will read and introduce a new poem, specially commissioned for the project. Till then, you can find out about the project at www.nationalgallery.org.uk/metamorphosis. With the Olympics about to open and the Diamond Jubilee just passed, this is a particularly significant and busy summer for London. If you're visiting the city or have guests coming to stay, it's worth remembering that the National Gallery is a free destination, open 7 days a week. And as Leah Caribbean discovered when she met up with Special Projects curator Colin Wiggins, with a little know-how, the gallery can also be a good place to find a quiet spot away from the crowds.
Well, this summer in London, Colin, it feels as if we're all fighting for even an inch of pavement, particularly at the front entrance to the gallery in Trafalgar Square. But lo, here we are at the back entrance to the gallery, and there's barely a soul in sight. Where are we?
Well, we are behind the National Gallery in Orange Street, which is the school's entrance, but it's also a public entrance. And, well, as you say, it's very nice and quiet. And that's really what we want to talk about today, how there are bits of the National Gallery that are very popular, like anything with a Van Gogh in is guaranteed to be pretty full of tourists ticking him off. But there are plenty of rooms in the National Gallery with lesser-known pictures by lesser-known artists that are equally rewarding, and you'll find them pretty unpopulated. And if I need a quiet 10 minutes or so, I will go and find a little quiet corner, and I hope to show you some of those today.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Where are you going to take me first?
I'd like to take you back to the Dutch Republic in the 17th century.
Well, this sort of room is completely different from the larger main rooms of the gallery. It's a really small, almost domestic space.
Yeah, it's designed to be a domestic space because the pictures in it are pictures that were meant for a domestic audience. These are pictures for basically the middle classes, and we must remember that the culture that produced these pictures, it's a new society. The Dutch Republic had just won its independence. These are not pictures for churches or palaces. These are pictures for private ownership. Now, just because these rooms have got small pictures in and there's nobody in, it doesn't mean we don't have really big names here, because look what we've got here in front of us. It's one of the two paintings that the gallery has by Vermeer. But the beauty of this is, while as we're talking, nobody can get near Van Gogh's sunflowers, this picture's ours. And isn't she a beauty?
Oh, she's really lovely, and it's a picture of a woman at a virginals, which is a sort of box-like harpsichord, which has this wonderful painted backboard with a landscape on it. She's absolutely fantastic. And it's so lovely to be this close.
Yeah, this close without anyone jostling you or anyone crashing into you, anyone pushing you out of the way, and there it is, and it's yours for as long as you like. She's a cracking picture too, isn't she? We're following a very vivid group, aren't we? They're not going to get lost in a hurry. I should say that this is a class of very small children who've all been issued with very bright yellow jackets, like health and safety high visibility jackets, as if they're out repairing a motorway. Maybe that's what they're doing this afternoon.
At the opposite end of the painting, in the bottom right corner, with the wheel, is St. Catherine of Alexandria. Now, all of these symbols...
As chance would have it, we're just actually encountering the morning guided tour. The guided tours in the week happen twice a day, and they're free, and they're very much aimed at the first-time visitor to give you a kind of overview of the whole range of the collection. And you'll see Stephen, my colleague Stephen Barrett's doing today's guided tour. Maybe you're picking him up on this now. I don't want to talk too loudly and interrupt him. But what he'll do is he'll choose five or six different pictures from the whole range of the gallery's collection and ending up in the 19th century rooms in about an hour or so. So it's fairly detailed because you'll get around 10 minutes on each picture, which is actually more, I think, than the average tourist would give a picture. And this, I think, is an absolutely ideal way to introduce yourself to ways of looking at pictures.
And here we've got, on the left, this is Mary Magdalene.
We seem to be at a bit of a crossroads here. There are many different ways we could go. If we're keeping to the quiet and the intimate, where do we go next?
Well, I would take you straight into the Sainsbury wing, but I would miss the Italians. I would steer clear of Giovanni Bellini and Botticelli, and I would go for the medieval German artists. Those rooms invariably are empty.
Wonderful. Colin, you're so right. We've just come through the Italian galleries.
Teeming,
with a whole school group in there. And here we are in the German rooms, and they're lovely and quiet. And what beautiful pictures, too.
They're spectacular pictures by great, great artists. But the thing is, we don't know their names because the artists didn't sign their pictures. There was no kind of cult of personality. And so what art historians have done with these pictures is group them together stylistically in terms of little collections of pictures that we can attribute to an unknown master. And then we make up a name. Like, for example, this picture here is by the master of the St. Bartholomew altarpiece. And just look at it. The craftsmanship is staggering, and the level of passion and human drama and grief is staggering. It's showing the descent from the cross. Now, Italian descents from the cross, Jesus looks hardly damaged, but in this one, boy, he's suffered. The wounds are ripping through his flesh, his arms are stiff from rigor mortis, all the reality of death is in there, and all the reality of grief is in there.
Yes.
When you look at the face of Mary Magdalene, for example, these are high quality, great, great pictures. But because they are anonymous, I think most visitors think, well, I will only look at things I know about, like Botticelli, and they see a label that says the master of the St. Bartholomew altarpiece, and actually somehow that prevents them from engaging with it. But you and the people listening to this podcast are better than that. So take your time to find these quiet corners and you will find works that are infinitely rewarding and just as remarkable as anything by the big names of the history of art.
Colin Wiggins talking to Leah Caribbean. You'll find Vermeer's A Young Woman Seated at a Virginal in room 27 and The Deposition by the master of the St. Bartholomew altarpiece in room 64. Guided tours of the National Gallery take place daily at 11:30 and 2:30. They're free to attend and kick off at the information desk in the Sainsbury Wing entrance. See the website for more information, www.nationalgallery.org.uk. That's almost it for this episode.
If you're visiting, the gallery is open from 10 till 6 daily and 10 till 9 on Fridays. Until next time, goodbye.